Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Rome's Gregorian University hosts an ecumenical conference marking the centenary of the birth of Cardinal Willebrands. The head of the Vatican's Council for Social Communications returns from Cuba with a call for greater freedoms for the Church. And with just 2 weeks to go before the start of the crucial Copenhagen Conference on Climate Change, author and missionary Father Sean McDonough spells out his hopes and fears for the future of our planet. Rome's Gregorian University on Thursday hosted an ecumenical conference marking the centenary of the birth of Dutch Cardinal Johannes Willebrands. A key figure at the Second Vatican Council and one of the main promoters of the Catholic Church's opening to other Christian traditions, Willebrands died in 2006 at the age of 96, at that time the oldest member of the College of Cardinals. Archbishop of Utrecht from 1975 to 1983, he's best remembered as a skilled diplomat with a sharp sense of humour who pioneered the Church's efforts at reconciliation amongst the divided Christian communities.
I think he might be just a little bit disillusioned that the fact is that one whole generation of ecumenists has disappeared, and where is the next generation coming from? How are they being formed? Where are they being formed?
Father Jim Puglisi is Minister General of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement and Director of the Centro Pro Unione here in Rome. Together with the Gregorian University and the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity, his centre helped organise the colloquium on Cardinal Willebrands. I asked him what he hopes such a conference can achieve.
I hope that, first of all, students are coming new to ecumenism, because here in Rome, you know, at the universities, we have many students who don't come from Europe. They come from other parts of the world, from Latin America, from Asia, and from Africa, and who might not know this part of our history, ecumenical history, that we present a person like Cardinal Willebrands, a person who was courageous, a person who lived through many changes in the Church. We have 100 years, you see, and he lived through some of the most challenging, when you think of the wars that he lived through as a young person, through the beginnings of the ecumenical movement in the beginning of the 1900s, to the formation of the World Council of Churches, to the preparation for the Second Vatican Council, and then for this wonderful job that he did at the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. That this is the person and also the values that I think young students, young ecumenists, budding ecumenists, if you want to call them that, need to emulate in their life. So this symposium not only remembers him as a person, but also the values that he brought to the whole ecumenical discussion, and also demonstrates the patience that one needs to have to work in this field, and also the expertise that one needs to have.
What do you think was it that gave him such inspiration, beginning at a time when ecumenism just simply wasn't on the Catholic agenda?
Probably being Dutch. He came from a church that had some very conservative roots, but at the same time were a people that wanted to explore, to experiment. Don't forget, they were great sailors, they were great navigators and explorers as far away as Indonesia, the United States of America. My state, New York, was New Amsterdam. It was a Dutch foundation. That there is this sense of exploration, because, you know, they live in a little country that has very tight boundaries about them, the sea on one side and other countries around them, so they have to find creative ways to go forward and to develop. And I think this was part of the spirit, which I call the Dutch spirit, that was there. And we think of some great theologians like Skillebecks and others who did this, but a lot of people who were involved in the ecumenical movement came from Holland. When you think of the first Secretary General of the World Council of Churches, Visser-Tufte was Dutch as well. A good number of the great people at the council were either Dutch or Belgian. So they had the same spirit of exploration from the Low Countries, if you want. And I think that's one of the things that contributes to that, plus his own academic formation. He was very much involved in studying a systematic theology and then even forming an ecumenical society before it could really be. It had a name which was kind of strange. It was for confutation of errors, you know. The original was more apologetic, but then he transformed it into something which was more creative. And this was, I guess, because of the great discoveries that we had in the biblical field, patristic and liturgical fields, and he was very much conversant in all three of those.
You worked very closely with him, didn't you, right up to the end of his life at the center. How do you remember him best as a person, if you had to paint a picture of this great man?
We had an informal relationship because the centro was independent of the pontifical council, but we did many things together, or he asked us to do things that the council really couldn't do, and so we were very happy to supply that. I remember him, we went just before he was leaving. The son of one of our secretaries came with me to pack up some of his library that he was donating to the centro. And he always had this twinkle in his eye that I always remember that, and always had a very good sense of humor. And as we were packing it up, he said, "Well, there goes a certain part of me. I guess I'll have to remember what I can retain in my own head and maybe from some people who remind me of the things that I used to know." And he was giving us a good part of his library for the centro. And the parts that were double, he said, "Well, you can give them away to places that need them." So very valuable materials that he gave us that we could share to seminaries which were in other parts of the world. He was a man that had a quick sense of humor, a man who loved sports, who loved to meet people. He loved to engage in any kind of conversation. I remember with the wife of the first director of the Anglican Center, Irina Finlow, he knew that one of the difficult things that he would have to deal with is to deal with the Russian church, which was still under the Soviet domination. And he said, "I can't rely on their translators, so I need to learn some Russian." So he went to Irene and he said, "Teach me Russian." So this is a Russo-Anglican Catholic dialogue, he said. So the other thing I remember finally is he was also the titular bishop of the churches of St. Cosmas and Damian, which is a Franciscan community there, the Third Order Regular. And on the feast of St. Cosmas and Damian in September, we always had a dinner there, and he'd be there and he'd always bring a box of cigars. That was a hallmark of his. He liked his good after-dinner drinks and his cigar.
My thanks there to Franciscan Father Jim Puglisi, director of the Centro Pro Unione here in Rome. Among the other key speakers at the colloquium were the head of the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, who will be meeting with Pope Benedict in the Vatican on Saturday. You can hear more details and interviews on our news and feature programmes over the coming days. A top Vatican official has called for greater freedom for the Church in Cuba to carry out its mission to the benefit of all people in the Caribbean island nation. Archbishop Claudio Chailly, head of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, visited Cuba during the first week of November, meeting with local bishops and laypeople, as well as with the government officials in charge of the state-run media. On his return to Rome, the Archbishop told me he was surprised and inspired to see just how much the Church is able to do despite the severe restrictions it faces.
It was my first visit to Cuba. I spent a very nice day talking with the bishops who were gathering for their assembly. And for sure we were talking about communication. The bishops were quite interested in knowing what we did in our assembly of the council and to know exactly also some actual reflections of the Church and of the Holy See about the presence of media in the modern world and the activity of the Church itself. And afterwards, I spent almost 2 days with people, lay people, coming from all the dioceses of Cuba. And with them we were talking about the presence of the Church in this field. I was deeply surprised and pleased because I realized that all these people were so happy to belong to the Church. And they were experiencing and they were expressing with joy this communion with the Holy Father and the Universal Church. You know, considering their situation in the country, for them was very positive and a source of happiness to see that somebody from the Holy See was among them. And we were talking, we were planning, we were considering what it is possible to do for the future. I was accustomed to say that I was surprised how, with some small things or little things, they are doing miracles. Because really, the actual situation of the country does not allow them to have great possibilities. But what they have in their hands is fully used to express, to communicate the Word of God, a reflection on social development also. So really, I'm coming back from Cuba full of hope and happy for what they do and how they do. With the local authorities, I was received by the Supreme Authority of Radio and Television in Cuba, by the Vice Minister of Communication. And it was a really, I would say, a cordial meeting. But at the same time, we were talking in a frank way. This is why I was expressing a wish that to the church is allowed, is permitted, to have a normal access to the media.
At the present time, the church has almost no access to the state media, does it?
They have a very limited access. It means that after the visit of Pope John Paul II in 1998, there was an improvement. It means that now every bishop is allowed to talk on the radio 3 times a year during 15 minutes. It means that in a year, a bishop is allowed to talk 45 minutes to the people. And it's a pity, because I think that the church today has the possibility not only to announce the gospel, but also to express human values so necessary for the good development of the Cuban population.
What kind of response did you get from the government when you were making these requests?
As I was saying, the atmosphere was cordial. We were talking around 2 hours. And the atmosphere was really cordial. They told me that they will consider what I was asking from them. You saw, for example, the same access to internet is limited only to the bishops, but they cannot use a broadband. They don't have a satellite access. They requested it already, since already many months, but until now, no response. And so in this dialogue with the authorities, I was expressing really the wish that such an access to the media is normalized. I don't expect a full freedom, but a more decent access, because I consider that really the church can give a great contribution to the welfare of the people and to the better social development of the country.
The church is allowed to carry out its normal activities within the churches, but does it have any freedom to carry out any other kind of pastoral ministry? Is it able to speak out on human rights, for example?
There are many limitations. The church, I think that really, in a wonderful way, they are doing what it is they are allowed now to do. But certainly, there are improvements. I heard that the dialogue and the atmosphere of the dialogue is more relaxed now.
With the government.
With the government, for sure. But until now, many, many aspects of the life of the church are under control. And so the church doesn't enjoy full freedom in its activity. So we need more time, I think.
What is the most important way that the Universal Church or the churches in the West can support the people there in Cuba?
As I was telling you, what I was experiencing in dealing with the people during these 2 days of working together, I realized that they were so happy for their belonging to the church and in feeling in deep communion with the Universal Church. I consider that it would be good if the particular churches can offer to the church in Cuba signs of communion, of closeness, of understanding, because really they needed a lot.
Were you able to talk at all about the politics and the lifting of the embargo with the government?
No. Certainly that the local authorities were stressing that some problems, economical problems, but also some other problems, are the consequence of an embargo. I was recalling to them the position of the Holy See, which was expressed on many occasions, because we consider that the embargo is creating more difficulties to the local population. I think that we must reconsider such a policy, because I think that new perspectives can favor other developments and a better situation for the local population, for sure.
You saw signs of great difficulty and great poverty, didn't you?
I was deeply moved by what a lady told me, because they were telling me very clearly that the suffering of a woman is to know or to see what to give to eat every day to the family, because there are some difficulties. Not every day some part of the food are available, for example. And so really families are perceiving such a situation. And I feel, you know, the people, they were expressing it in a very frank way, I would say. So I think that who is in charge of taking decisions, they have to reconsider it, I think.
Thanks there to Archbishop Claudio Celi, President of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. With just a couple of weeks to go before the start of the crucial Copenhagen Conference on Climate Change, religious leaders around the world are mobilising their communities to send a unified message to world leaders about the urgency of this issue. Christian church leaders and representatives of many different faith communities will be present in the Danish capital for the conference, which takes place from December the 7th to 18th. On Sunday the 13th, the Secretary-General of Caritas Internationalis, Leslie Ann Knight, will be joining other Catholic leaders in ringing church bells in Copenhagen. They hope to remind politicians of the moral imperative to reach agreement on cutting carbon dioxide emissions to reduce global warming. Parishes and dioceses around the globe are also being encouraged to lead their own bell-ringing appeal at 3 p.m. local time on the 13th.
And I would hope in every church between now and December, people would begin to pray, or for the leaders who are going to come there, that they have the courage to actually make these decisions now.
Well-known author and missionary Columban Father Sean McDonough will also be in Copenhagen following closely the workings of this summit. He told me exactly what's at stake at this conference and why the Catholic Church must keep this issue at the top of its agenda over the coming weeks.
I take my standard here from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These are the scientists who have been looking at climate change since 1988. There are about 3,000 of them, and they cover a whole array of sciences, from physics to meteorology to all kinds of different. So they're looking at climate changing around the world right now. They have asked, as a scientific necessity, that rich countries, like what they call Annex 1 countries, like the United States, most of Europe, that we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by between 25 and 40% by the year 2020. And that's really essential if we're going to keep the mean global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius. If we don't, it could go spiking. So that's what's on the table. So let's have a look at where the players are at. Well, first of all, from the United States of America, thanks be to God, we have President Obama. He is committed to climate change. His own people in the Treasury are actually committed to it. But the United States process works quite differently. You have to bring in climate change legislation into the House of Representatives and also into the Senate. So you need to have almost 60 senators on your side to get through, and it's slow. So I don't think he'll be able to come with a commitment from the American delegation to these specific numbers. I think they'll try to say, we'd like to see us reaching there. Because he knows, you know, the reality of the fault lines of the United States at the moment. One of them is around healthcare. He fears, and rightly so, because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has come out recently very strongly against climate legislation, although some companies have actually pulled away from that and say, no, we better get real. But he knows there could be a fault here, and it could be political, Democrat and Republican. So he'll be trying to be as competitive as possible, but also trying to make sure, because he knows it's going to affect the United States like everywhere else.
The European governments have been a little more optimistic, perhaps, many of them trying to commit to these goals.
They have. The European government, we have a couple of things out of the way. Elections. Last year, polls announced the election in Germany. This year was one of the major bugbears on the screen. Because in countries like Germany, you have steel making, you have car making, and you have mining. And like they are big users and they're big polluters of CO2. So the Chancellor Angela Merkel was much less committive in Poznan than she was, for example, in Bali the previous year. And then, of course, Poland is now one of the major countries of the European Union, and 80-90% of its energy comes from coal. So those are issues. But it would appear that the European Union will be willing to do the 25-40%, which is... Now, I just like to tell people, this will change the way we live. I may not be sitting here in 2022 if this actually goes through, because it's going to change the way we use energy, the way we travel, the way we embody energy into all the resources we have around us. People should be under no illusion. Don't forget, with Kyoto, they were only asking for 5-7% back in 1997. This is big business. Now, you can help somewhat by the new technologies, but you're going to also have to see a lot of cutback. Then looking across the board at the newly emergent economies. Well, for example, China is now the gross number one polluter, is up to 26%, but of course per capita, it's only 1/5 of a per capita in the United States and less in Europe. They are beginning to say, we're willing to jump with you, but they say to you, look, the Industrial Revolution started at the end of the 18th century. Your prosperity for the last 200 years has been based on fossil fuel, first coal, then oil, then natural gas. So you've got all this prosperity behind you. You shouldn't be asking us to jump as fast as you're jumping, because we've only started on this game. And by the way, okay, you point at the 400 million people who are now middle class, and you probably see some of them wandering around here, Rome, as tourists. But what about the 600 million people who are still living in major poverty? They say, we need to have some kind of growth that actually will take them out of poverty. But they are also well aware that they are extremely vulnerable and becoming more well aware, because the number one vulnerability in climate change after severe weather, which we've seen in the Philippines, is glacier melt. And the biggest glaciers, apart from Greenland and Antarctica, are on the Himalayas. All the rivers of Asia come out of that, including the Yangtze. So if it melts by 80% by 2030, China is in real problem. The Yangtze provides water for 300 million people. The Yellow River provides much the same, and it comes off the Tibet Plateau. So they're aware and they want to do things. But there will be delicate negotiations right there between the historic people who are like us in Western Europe, whose prosperity was built based on this, and they who are saying, OK, they are putting huge money into alternatives, I must say, wind and even photovoltaic. So I'd have more hope now with China and China and the United States, particularly with the Obama administration on, that there would be some agreement. I'm hoping they don't pare it back to 20%. That's all I'm basically saying.
Because if we do pare it back even to 20%, which is quite close to the targets we're looking at.
If we do, then we may not reach the goal, which is to keep the average global temperature below a 2 degrees Celsius rise. You see, one of the things the science is doing is the science is telling us, actually, it's more serious, almost certainly by the 6 months and years. If I was here a year ago, for example, which I probably was, at that stage we were saying we could have carbon dioxide in the air or its equivalent, we could have 440 parts per million, and it wouldn't make that huge difference. Now they're saying that isn't true. We actually need to pare it back to 350. Now we're already at 390. So you can understand the kind of difficulties that we'll have for people, and particularly for people in third world countries.
So you're saying there's much greater scientific precision over these issues now.
Absolutely.
There's much greater awareness, you're saying, also on the parts of governments, but perhaps not the necessary political conviction to push this agreement through. What are you actually looking for to come out of the conference?
Oh, I'm looking for these countries, what they call Annex 1, the rich countries, do sign up to 25%. And I think that's one place where the churches and people who are in moral positions could be very helpful, because it's going to be difficult. I think the churches, this is a real issue about the well-being of human beings into the future. I mean, it's not one of these issues that, well, we can put it on the long finger. If you wanted to use theological language, it's Kairos moment, which is a crisis. And what I would like to see is the Catholic Church, the leadership of the Catholic Church, being quite specific in this area. Like, there is 3 or 4 paragraphs on ecology in general in the recent papal encyclical by His Holiness Pope Benedict. But I would have loved to have seen a much more clear engagement, like he does on the economy or on labour, with the issues of climate change, and particularly taking on board. I think we can take on board the reality of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. By the way, as I say, it's 3,000 people, and they actually work on lowest common denominators. And on some areas, for example, they won't publish data on it because there's not, for example, a consensus. Like, for example, whether the North Atlantic, the stream, the Gulf Stream that keeps Europe warm, will actually be diluted with the fresh water coming off Greenland and off the Russian River. So they don't come to conclusions on that. So they're very conservative. I would like to see us coming behind that with the moral power to say, look, this is going to be very challenging, but it is for the well-being of you, the poor particularly today, and all humans to come, and also the well-being of the earth. And to put it in those religious languages, to have the precision of the science behind us, that we're not just saying be good and look after the environment and don't throw away. No, we're saying we have looked at this issue, and we think, in the same way as in number 63, for example, of Caritas in Veritate, the Pope can say, I think the International Labour Organization's regulations in terms of migrant workers should be promoted. In other words, the Church is throwing its backing morally behind that kind of position. I'd love to see the same on climate change. And I think if a group like the Roman Catholic Church came out in favour of that, and in his presentation was seen to be very competent, and was seen to be really concerned about the well-being of humans and also about the urgency of it, I think that would have huge impact. First of all, in terms of preaching the gospel of life, people say, here's a church that actually is willing to put his neck on the line. And also, because as a priest who's into this area, I find young people respond to religion if you present it to them in terms of their concerns like climate change. And like if people went in, I'm going with the Franciscans International, I'm a missionary, my basic concerns will be the adaptation fund, because we're missionaries and we see what's happening. I've had been on to Manila there for the last week about what has happened to the poor of Manila, because we have a parish there. So we're very aware of that. Other groups are on to mitigation and the green pieces and all of those. But we want to get, and that would be an important role also for the church on that particular adaptation, that the church would be very, very clear. And it can be, because the Church, the Catholic Church, is a global organisation, and yet it's a local organisation. You have parishes, you have dioceses in Africa, you have parishes, dioceses in Rome and Ireland. And that coming together with knowledge, with commitment and competence, I think would be very, very powerful. And I think we probably would get an agreement at Copenhagen. And then last, because this is certainly part of the Christian world, I would hope in every church between now and December, people would begin to pray, or for the leaders who are going to come there, that they have the courage to actually make these decisions now.
Thanks there to Columban Father Sean McDonough. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.